Thank you. Thank you. Hi. So my name is Ming Yi. I just recently graduated from CX Trends Group at Stanford and have since just moved on to a postdoc position with Bob Birgeneau at Berkeley. But what I'm going to talk about today, we're all work done at Stanford with CX. So I would like to thank the organizers for giving me this great opportunity to talk to all of you about our work on the electron correlation effects in iron-based superconductors seen by ARPES. So let me begin by thanking all of our collaborators. So the ARPES work were done in CX's group, mainly with Zhongkai Liu and Yan Zhang, and also with Donghui Lu at Slack. And we have had wonderful samples from various sources, from Ian's group, Paul's group, and CQ Mao's group. And also, we have some films grown locally in our lab, in particular, the iron-selenium film on STO. And finally, we have had a wonderful collaboration with Tianmiao Sun, Rong Yu, and Jian Xinzhu on the theoretical part for this project. So this is the phase diagram of the iron-based superconductors. And I understand the question we all try to understand is, how do we understand the superconductivity in iron-based superconductors? And I think there's been more and more evidence seeing that it's not in the weak correlated limit, such as chromium, nor is it in the very strongly correlated Mott insulating case of the cuprates, but it's somewhere in between. For example, maybe the incipient Mott scenario. So I guess what I will try to show today is study of the correlation effects in this region and how we can observe that from ARPES. So my talk will be divided into three major chunks. First, a very brief introduction of how we measure the electron correlation effects by ARPES. And then I will talk about the iron chalcogenides in more detail, how we observe some orbital dependent correlation effects there. And then finally, I will show you some overall trends of electron correlation over all the iron-based superconductors. So the first part, we all know that ARPES directly measures electronic structure via the single particle spectral function here, which contains the bare band dispersion information and also the self-energy term, which captures the effects of interaction. So in the very non-interacting limit, this simplifies to just delta functions. And we, for example, a simple parabolic band dispersion. If we have interaction, then the single particle spectral function can be divided into two parts, a coherent part, which resembles non-interacting limits, delta-like, and then the incoherent part, which are incoherent backgrounds there. So if we look at the coherent part, there's the Z vector, which is the coherent factor, which is always smaller than 1. And the first effect is that it reduces the overall spectral weight by a factor. Another effect is that it renormalizes the band dispersions by a factor. So the electrons, the bands are renormalized, so it's more localized and more massive. So these are effects that we can observe directly with ARPES to study the electron correlation. For example, this is a 1111 phosphide measured band dispersions. If we compare with LDA bare bands, we can see that we need to squeeze the LDA down by a factor about 2.2. to make it match with the data. So this factor is a direct measure of electron correlation. And this is something we can study for all the materials. So let me now go to this now famous plot of Gabby's, which has shown 5 million times today. But it's a very nice summary of the correlation effect in the iron-based superconductors, which shows that going from the phosphide end to the chalcogenide end, the effective mass increases. So there's a systematic change of the correlation strength. And from ARPES, we can see this clearly. I show you an example of a phosphide material, an arsenide material, and a chalcogenide material. These are cuts, the same cut taken from the gamma point to the end point, a high symmetry cut, and with the same energy window. So if I highlight this band, which is DYZ in character, because we can see the top and the bottom, we can look at the bandwidth. And you can compare that it shrinks down from the phosphide to the arsenide to the chalcogenide. So here we do see the systematic bandwidth shrinking going from this end to this end. And this is something I will come back to in the later part. But first, I want to first tell you about the interesting things we see in the most correlated part, which is the iron chalcogenides. So in the iron trichotillon, I think it's fair to say there are three very representative systems. There's the 1-1 material, the iron, tellurium, selenium, and then there's the 1-2-2, which is the first one with insulating behavior. And then finally, I think it's fair to put the monolayer film into its own category because of its peculiarity. Then I will show you that taking a superconducting sample out of each family, I will show you that they actually have very similar behavior in terms of electron correlation. But first, let me just take the 1-2-2 as an example and go into details with this particular family. So here's the 1-2-2 chalcogenide Fermi surface mapping. The green line is the 2 iron boron zone. These are the zone corners where we see that there are large electron pockets. And if we take a high symmetry cut, this is the raw data along this cut. This is the second derivative, which we can observe the band dispersions more clearly. And then we can compare it side by side with the iron nictide, so chalcogenide and nictide, same cut. What we first observe is that this blue band, marked in blue, is the DYZ hole-like band. It's much more flatter in the chalcogenide than the other orbitals, whereas in the iron nictides, you see that this band has very similar slope as the other ones. This is the first observation, very flat DXY band. Second observation is if you look at the zone corner, you see that there is an energy gap between the bottom of the electron band and the top of the hole band, and it's not there in the 1-2-2. And this degeneracy is protected by the C4 symmetry of the crystal. However, in the iron trichotillonite, the such C4 symmetry breaking has not been observed. So why is this there? So these are the two observations we see. Now, if we look at the LDA, we see the LDA calculation for the trichotillonite is similar as the one as the nictide. So how do we understand this? We can look at the renormalization factor of these bands in an orbital-dependent way. So compared with the LDA, we see that the hole-like XY band is renormalized by a factor around 10, much more than the factor of 3 for the other bands. And this strong renormalization of the XY band pushes this band up such that it crosses this XZ electron-like band and opens up a hybridization gap. Hence, without breaking the C4 symmetry, we can observe if there is such an energy gap observed. So this renormalization of the XY explains both observations we saw earlier. Next, let's zoom in to this electron band and show you some interesting temperature dependence. So I'm just going to zoom in, and this is the same window. This is the electron band. This is data taken at low temperature. This is an EDC plot where you can see follow the peak, which is the shallow electron band. When we raise temperature, we notice that at high temperature, this becomes a deep electron band. And that's even more clearly in the EDC plot. You can see it goes from a shallow electron band to a deep electron band. And this can be qualitatively understood if we imagine, coming back to our schematic, if we imagine that this XY band disappears at high temperature, then it naturally would recover this deep electron band. Well, how do we know that XY truly disappeared? So here, we can do a more quantitative analysis. Same data, same low temperature data in this window. If we take a look at the EDC in the middle through this bottom of this electron band, we see the bottom of this electron band is DXY in character. So the spectral weight we pick up here, belongs to the XY orbital. So we can directly track the spectral weight of this little peak, which would tell us the behavior of the XY orbital. And that as a function of temperature disappears. So this is the plotted spectral weight of the XY band as the function of temperature disappears. So we see that it diminishes with temperature. So these are what happens with the 1-2-2. Now I'm going to compare side by side the three compounds. And you see that, first of all, this very flat XY band is flat in all three compounds. It's even more so in the monolayer film. So this is the monolayer film, and this is data taken in the second boron zone. Here you can see, without intensity for the other ones, you can see this flat band very well. And just as a side note, this kind of matrix element So this is a calculated matrix element, expected photon emission matrix element for the DXY orbital. What you see is that the DXY orbital is expected to have increasing intensity in the second zone compared to the first zone. That is why we can see the spectral wave in the second zone more clearly. So this is our way of knowing that this flat band is indeed the XY Holeck band. So this is a flat XY Holeck band. The second feature we observe is that there is this energy gap in all three systems. And also we can see in this shallow electron band there are actually two nearly degenerate electron bands. There's the outer one, which is more intense, and there's a weaker one on the inside. Perhaps you can see that better if we take a MDC along a near Fermi level. Here, under each peak, there are actually two peaks, indicating there are two Fermi crossings. So here is another confirmation of our understanding of this phenomenon. Let me just, so here, this is our schematic. Let me just take a moment and dwell on this universality a little bit, I think to appreciate it a little bit more. This behavior of this strongly renormalized XY is an effect in all the chalcogenides. It's independent of the Fermi surface topology. So for the 1-1 compounds, the Fermi surface topology has nearly compensated hole band, hole pockets and electron pockets. And for these two, there is the lack of the hole pockets in the middle. So these correlation effects are independent of Fermi surface topology. It is also independent of extrinsic effects such as phase separation in the 1-2-2 material. So this is just a very, I think, another confirmation of our understanding. And then the temperature dependence. So here is the low temperature data compared with the high temperature data. What we see is that the whole XY band disappears in all three systems. And second of all, this gap also disappears. And this disappearance of the gap, again, is indication that the XY band has disappeared. Quantitatively, we can also look at these two systems, the monolayer film and the 1-1 system, and track the spectral weight. If we take a cut at a certain momentum, we can pick out the spectral weight of the XY band and also higher bands, which are the YZ, and track the intensity of these two orbitals as a function of temperature. And we see that for both systems, again, the XY orbital dies away, while the XZ and YZ remain metallic. So this kind of behavior in collaboration, so this is the orbital-dependent behavior. In collaboration with Rong Yu and Qimiao, they suggested this is the orbital selective Mott behavior, which is that the crystal field splitting splits the XY orbital to be higher than that of XZ and YZ, such that it's possible for the XY orbital to be near half-filled when the system is not half-filled. And because of the orbital interaction of XZ and YZ, it is possible for the XY orbital to become Mott localized before the other orbitals. And they have done a calculation which shows that when you have finite J, Hans J, and the Coulomb U, this 1-2-2 material can have a Mott insulating phase. And there's a certain path in which the material can go from a metallic phase to the Mott insulating phase through an orbital selective Mott phase. So for example, if we take a path at a certain J along U, this shows us the coherence factor Z. It first is in the metallic phase, and then when it crosses this dashed line, the spectral wave rapidly drops, but still remain finite. That's the strongly correlated metallic phase. And then at a certain large enough U, the XY orbital becomes Mott localized, while the other ones remain metallic. Hence, we're in the orbital selective Mott phase. And then finally, can go into the Mott insulating phase. Now, if we are at somewhere close to this orbital select Mott phase at low temperature, then you can imagine with raised temperature, such as in this phase diagram for doped n equals 6.15, if we're close to this orbital selective Mott phase at low temperature, then raising the temperature, we can cross over into the orbital selective Mott phase. And this is Z for the various orbitals as a function of temperature. Then we can go into such a state from temperature, and this is the calculated spectral function. So this is the U equals the zero limit, which is the LDA limit. Here you have the hole bands and electron bands. The blue color is the DXY band again. And then when we have finite U, what that does is that it flattens out the XY orbital, so that we have an orbital-dependent renormalization effect. And then raising temperature, the XY orbital diminishes, such that eventually we're in the orbital selective Mach phase. I think Rome may talk about this more on Wednesday, but this is consistent with what we observe experimentally. So let me briefly summarize this part, which is that in iron chalcogenides, we observe that at low temperature, the DXY to be strongly renormalized compared to the other orbitals. And also, with temperature, the XY orbital spectral weight diminishes. And this is consistent with the orbital selective Mach picture. And very importantly, this is a universal behavior in all the chalcogenide materials that we have studied, including the monolayer field. So next, let me go on to some systematic trends that we observe. So coming back to this summary figure, we see that, firstly, the overall bandwidth, here represented by the DYZ bandwidth, shrinks going from phosphide to the chalcogenides. The other thing is that if I mark out in blue the XY band, what you notice is that it has similar slope as the YZ in the phosphide, but it becomes increasingly more flattened towards the chalcogenide, so that the orbital selectivity also increases from this end to that end. So these are two interesting factors that we'll focus on. First, let's look at the overall normalization. So here we measure, the comparison here is that we compare the YZ bandwidth with LDA, and this is data taken from literature from I'm acknowledging all the wonderful ARPA's work done by around the world. I'm just taking all the compounds that we could find. So here the trend we see is that compared with the bond length, which is the iron nictitin bond length, we see that the shorter the bond length is, the weaker the correlation is. So the phosphides are down here. And then we have the phosphorus dope bearing 1-2-2, and then our other iron arsenides. And then here are the iron, tellurium, selenium chalcogenides. And we see a very systematic spread of the correlation effect. This is plotted for DYZ. This is plotted for DXY, which has even larger dynamic range, so up to 30. The second factor, so that makes sense because the bond length controls the how itinerant these electrons are. The second factor that controls the correlation effect is doping. So here I plot two series. One is the 1-2-2 series with hole doping, potassium hole doping, and cobalt electron doping. And the other series is lithium 111 doped with cobalt. And you notice the undoped is here at 6, but half filling is at 5. That is why the hole doped side becomes more correlated than the electron-like dope side. So these are the two factors that control. So applied together, we see that the longer the bond length, and the more hole dope, the strongly correlated the system becomes. And so this is the overall correlation effect. And this is was done earlier in optics by Uchida's group, and also the similar conclusion. And then the second factor that we'll look into is the DXY versus DYZ renormalization ratio. So this is a measure of the orbital selectivity. So how correlated the XY is compared to YZ. And we notice that it has a systematic relation with the overall renormalization. So the weaker the renormalization, the weaker the orbital selectivity. Again, here are the phosphides, the arsenides, and the chalcogenides. Also, it has a dependence on the structure parameters. And here on the left is plotted with bond angle. So this is the iron, the arsenic or nictogen, iron nictogen bond angle. And you can imagine the smaller the bond angle is, the more the taller stretch in z direction. And that makes a bigger difference for the XY orbital than the other orbitals, hence the more orbital selectivity in the chalcogenides. And also, in very similar fashion, it had has a sensitivity to the anion height. And the taller the anion height, the stronger the orbital selectivity. So here we see that the orbital selectivity depends on the overall correlation, also the structure parameters. So this part, we see that there's a systematic spread of the correlation strength in iron-based superconductors, and also the correlation increases in an orbital-dependent way. I would like to end with a very interesting view of the phase diagram. So here is something we used to see, which is the cuprates versus nictite in such a way where the parent compounds are here and the magnetic phases are compared side by side. However, I think it's a very interesting proposal by Luca de' Medici here, where he suggests that rather than looking at the parent compounds, or the magnetic phase as a parent compound, suppose that these magnetic SDW is really due to the Fermi surface instability. And if you ignore that, then you recover a superconducting dome in such a fashion, and then the hole dope side, you will approach a Mott insulating side, whereas in Fermi liquid on the other side. This horizontal axis is the average orbital doping, because the orbitals are doped at different rates for the different five different orbitals. In such a picture, it is much similar to the cuprate problem, the way we were seeing it before. And this transition is crossed over from the Mott insulating phase to the superconducting phase is done in an orbital selective way. So we don't know if this is really the correct picture, but I think at least it's a very interesting different perspective. So
the blue line in the middle is just fantasy, right?
I'm sorry?
The blue line in the middle, instead of the blue dot.
This?
Yeah, above that, the blue line.
Yes.
Yes, that line.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
That's from. You mean why there's a kink and all that? Yes, that's a good question. Maybe someone should, yeah. Thank you, that's all.
Thank you very much for this nice talk. We have in the, okay, let me start in the front and then I will call.
So why does the why does the region of selective Mottness increase as you raise the temperature? In that phase diagram you had, as you increase the temperature, you enter the orbital selective phase. So why is that higher temperature?
I understand that this is my understanding is that this is a multi-orbital system. So in the single orbital system, then it's the other way. But in the multi-orbital system, it depends on the details of the calculation. So I don't know if your room can, yeah.
Maybe, yes. Let me just go here.
So when we usually talk about this Mottness insulator, it's actually the low temperature, you refer to this antiferromagnetic insulator. But here we're talking about a paramagnetic insulator.
Well, I understand that, but why?
Yeah.
What does it become
you
more
can,
stable?
You can just think that paramagnetic insulator, you have a larger entropy than this usual Fermi liquid, the magnetic phase. And then if you compare the free energy, then definitely the insulating phase will be more favorable at a higher temperature.
Mott insulator has zero entropy, but okay. This is thermal entropy, that is. I wouldn't call it a Mott state.
Okay, so I have
So as you just mentioned, right, by symmetry, at the end point, you should have two doublets, right? One is the two XY orbitals forming one doublet, and the other is an XZ and YZ orbital, right? So are you saying that one of these two doublets is disappearing as function of temperature? Because if there's no XY orbital, then you should see a doublet that just disappears at some temperature or slowly disappears.
Double, you mean the degeneracy point?
At the end point, at the high symmetry point.
Yes, the XY goes away. So the reason is
that... But the data shows just one doublet then at high temperatures.
Yes.
All right.
Does it mean that excitations just become completely incoherent and you cannot see any peaks?
Yeah.
Or you can still follow sort of coherent band which shrinks in.
Yeah, the spectral wave completely goes away. So we
and
no
how
longer
you know
see.
That it's more,
I'm sorry?
How you know that it's an orbital circuit mode transition, not just disappearance of coherent excitation?
I don't know if experimentally. Yeah.
Would you expect to see a lower power band if this were a mode transition?
If it were single, I imagine for a single band picture, then you should see a lower upper band. But if it's a multiple order, multi-orbital system, then some of the spectral wave could be transferred to other orbitals, or it's harder to observe the lower Hubbard band for that orbital. I don't know if that's.
I had a much more basic question, which is regarding the disappearance of spectral weight.
Mm-hmm.
How do you verify that this is coming from the DXY orbital? Is it?
Oh,
how is that determined?
Yes, so experimentally we can use the matrix elements to determine which band is dominantly what orbital using the light polarization and the symmetry of the orbitals. Yeah, so.
Gabby?
So a few years ago we also predicted these system-specific calculations for the iron telluride. Did you try to see if the orders of magnitude that we were predicting for how this DXY orbital disappears, which is along the lines that people were mentioned there. It's not a mod transition, it's just a Coons-induced transfer spectral wave takes place, and how does it do vis-a-vis your experiments?
Yeah, experimentally, I don't think we can distinguish the two pictures for whether it just becomes a coherent crossover or if it's.
Yeah, but we did very specific calculations, so we sort of put numbers.
Yeah.
Did you try to see if your data?
You mean the temperature?
Yeah, I mean the temperature scales, the weights.
Yeah, so that was the iron tellurium. Yeah. That's the iron tellurium system.
Yes.
So that one has the bicollinear SCW at low temperature. So it's very incoherent. So it's difficult to see the bends very well.
Okay, one more question. Sorry, please, Dennis. Do you know the work by Bosono where he put hydrogen, right?
Uh-huh.
And he studied this as a function of hydrogen doping. And the phase diagram looks quite different. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, there are two domes of the superconductor. Is that things are not universal or what?
Yeah, it's not like from the phase.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's sort of the most natural way to dope, just stick hydrogen in the sample, right?
Yeah, not on the spot, sorry.
This is just a question about the polarization analysis again. We heard a talk last week about some new data on potassium iron selenide from another group where it was suggested that there might be a band which has not been reported until now, an XY whole band near the gamma point. And the suggestion was that this type of matrix element was intrinsically much smaller for some reason, and therefore it hadn't been observed before. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I'm very glad you asked because I actually prepared for that. So my understanding of that is that let me just find the slide. So my understanding is that the way that the hole-like band was observed, that one that crosses the Fermi level, that was determined by taking a second derivative in the momentum dimension rather than the energy dimension. So here I just do a very simple simulation. If you just have a hole-like band that's rather flat, if you take a second derivative in the momentum direction, you're going to get some artifact that looks like it's going towards a higher energy than the original band. So this is very similar. You can imagine because there's a residual spectral wave even above, because of the finite line width, even above the band, you're going to get some residual hump which will show up in the second derivative in the momentum direction. So it'll look like there's a dispersion that it's different than the one that's than the one taking the energy direction. So this is the problem, I think, is similar to the croup rates where people were talking about the waterfall effect, where you have some, it looks like there was some vertical band, which was really just the residual spectral wave from the deep band. So my hunch is that this is what happened. Of course, I should let the other group also defend themselves. Yeah.
Okay, so we have one more question from Rafael and from Carlos. The data Peter was talking about was a very recent experiment done by Yokoya in Okayama University, and it has a much more steep dispersion, and it looks very likely that it's crossing the Fermi level. So maybe we can talk.
We should talk offline. Yeah. Magnetic sensibility. Yeah, you're saying that because there's orbital selective Mach transition, you should have some sort of jump. Yeah. It doesn't have a jump, that I can tell you.
But is it monotonically increasing?
I shouldn't say anything if I'm not sure. So I can show you later.
Okay. Are there any more questions? Yes.
So mode state is kind of a catchphrase for everything, and so for the particular theory that was done in this case, what kind of a mode state is it? Can one of the authors comment?
I think it is probably is too much detail for the experiment today. So since I give another talk on Wednesday, so maybe let's see it on Wednesday. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for the last. I have a question. Usually, in order to see these band renormalizations, one always looks what happens near the Fermi level, whether you have band renormalizations. So if we are talking about some kind of modness, did you also analyze what happens when you go to higher binding energies, right? So if you have some modness, you may have some spectral wave transfer, and maybe you see some kind of lower Hubbard band. Have you analyzed, in fact, when you go down, also high binding energies, what happens with your spectral weight?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And do you see something special there?
I should do that. I will do that. Thank you.
Shimya.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I think in the case of potassium iron selenides, there was a work by the Fudan University group which analyzed just that. And there was considerable incoherent features which were identified.
Yes. Are there any more questions or comments? If not, we thank you very much again, and we go to the doctor.